Welcome to episode 223 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com. It is Father's Day, Sunday, June 17th, 2012. I am the Solid Monster. Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there, including one of our own, very good friend to the show, Mr. Brian Blade, who is now a proud papa for the first time, his newborn son, Dylan, born yesterday. Very happy for Brian, and I'm sure today is a very happy Father's Day for him, so I just wanted to mention that right here off the bat. Tonight also happens to be a WWE pay-per-view, No Way Out, from the Izod Center in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Going to run down the card really quick here. Show is headlined by, what else, a John Cena main event. Not the WWE Championship, or the world title for that matter. I believe this makes the fifth pay-per-view that we've had this, and kind of ridiculous at this point, but this is how it is. John Cena and The Big Show in a steel cage match. And there's some new stipulations added to this match, in that if John Cena loses, we found out at the end of SmackDown Friday night, he will be fired. Yeah, really. There's something we've never heard before. And if Big Show loses, John Laurinaitis is fired from his position as the, I guess, the GM of both Raw and SmackDown. Vince McMahon may or may not be at ringside. He had mentioned on Raw Monday night that he would be, and then he was promptly knocked out by the Big Show. And what I can only hope is a setup to an angle that I may or may not have pitched on the show before, kind of a Vince McMahon amnesia storyline, where Vince gets knocked loopy, kind of like Dr. Emmett Brown in Back to the Future when he gets bopped on the head and, you know, goes all nutty and created the flux capacitor for time travel. And I can only hope that by getting knocked out by the Big Show, we see Vince McMahon come back in his tux and bow tie, thinking that he is, in fact, the old announcer, Vince McMahon. I just think that'd be a hell of a gimmick, actually, if Vince thought that it was 20 years ago. But anyway, whether he's there or not is something we'll find out tonight. We're not quite sure yet. As far as the stipulations are concerned, I don't really know what else to say about it at this point. It's almost, I get the impression, I know this is not why they do it, but I almost get the impression that they add these firing stipulations just for their own shits and giggles, just to piss people off. Just to piss off the fans on the internet, just because it is so completely absurd every single time they do a firing stipulation, particularly for a John Cena match, because we've seen this twice before. Survivor Series 2010, John Cena, special guest referee for the Wade Barrett-Randy Orton main event. And if John Cena didn't, quote, do the right thing and basically help Barrett win, then he was going to be fired. And of course, Cena did not help Barrett win. Orton won that match, and Cena was technically fired and then proceeded to not miss. I don't think he missed a single show. Even the next night, I think he was still there on the Titantron. So he basically never missed a show after that for somebody, again, who was supposed to be fired. And then you fast forward to Money in the Bank, 2011 last year. Big championship match, John Cena, CM Punk, probably my favorite match of the entire year. And the stipulation there was that if Vince McMahon said that if John Cena does not leave with the WWE Championship, if he allows CM Punk, who is becoming a free agent, to leave with his title, John Cena would in fact be fired. And what do you know? CM Punk won the WWE title, and John Cena never did get fired. Vince McMahon tried to fire him, and then they did that whole thing where Triple H came out and said that Vince didn't have any power, which is kind of funny, being that Vince is now back clearly in power, and they never really bothered to explain that. You have a steel cage main event with John Cena and The Big Show. You want to do the stipulation for Laurinaitis, that's fine. In fact, my prediction for this match is that Cena finds a way to win, and Laurinaitis will, in fact, be fired as the GM of both shows. But I would suspect that the Laurinaitis character will stick around, maybe in some other role. Maybe he'll be a manager, or some other thing. Supposedly, there were some house show lineups released prematurely that indicated John Laurinaitis, rather, was going to be the new liaison to the board of directors, which they may have tipped their cap on that one as far as what may happen tonight at the pay-per-view. I guess we'll find out. But John Cena lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. He beat Brock Lesnar. He lost to John Laurinaitis. He beat Michael Cole on Raw. These are the big matches John Cena's had recently. So I suppose you could argue that Cena is due for another loss. But again, at the last pay-per-view, he lost to a non-wrestler. I would suspect that John Cena should be in a position to win this match, because for John Cena to lose, and for the third time after a pay-per-view, for them to do some bullshit firing stipulation, I would say that they're killing the firing stip. But let's be honest, whether it's WWE or TNA, the whole idea of firing people, I've never seen an industry before or another sport where people were so interested in firing other people. It's like, you know, if two football teams in the NFL have a game, does the commissioner pipe in? Does Roger Goodell interject himself and say, okay, you know, we're going to have this game this weekend, this big game, and if this team loses, then their coach is fired? You know, maybe their coach is fired, I suppose, you know, at the end of the season if his team doesn't do well, but it would be completely ludicrous. You know, if you have these talented individuals, why would you want to constantly fire them? Why would WWE, even in, as a heel authority figure with John Laurinaitis, I mean, why would you want to fire your main drawing card? Does it make any sense at all? The stipulation itself doesn't make any sense. Why would you want these people fired? It's completely ludicrous. And quite frankly, it just makes it almost impossible for me to get into these matches when they do these stupid stipulations, because it's all bullshit. Nobody could possibly believe that anybody is getting fired here. And you've got the Big Show on SmackDown, I believe it was, cutting a promo, or maybe it was Raw, talking about how, well, you know, if I get fired or something like that, I'm going to, you know, collect a whole bunch of money to sit home and do nothing. This is the same Big Show, mind you, that several weeks ago was on his hands and knees groveling for his job, literally tears streaming down his face. And it wasn't like a big ruse or a big setup. That wasn't the big reveal. What ended up happening was, you know, the Big Show ended up coming to an agreement with Laurinaitis to come back. It wasn't like that was all just an act. They weren't crocodile tears, although they were, you know, for the sake of the entertainment. But, you know, Big Show really was groveling for his job and on the microphone telling everybody, I don't do this for the money. I do this because I love it. I do this because I love the people. And obviously, he's had quite the attitude adjustment over the last couple of weeks, because now he'd be content to just sit home and collect money from his big, fat, ironclad contract. So they can't even keep their shit straight, you know, from one week to the next, and I don't know. Perhaps that has something to do with why I really just don't care about this match. But I'll go with John Cena, just because for him to lose means he would be fired, and we all know that's not going to happen. CM Punk, Kane, Daniel Bryan, triple threat match for the WWE Championship. And this is another interesting situation here, because I made no bones about the fact that I was very disappointed that they added Kane to the mix here. And I've always been a Kane fan. They haven't really done much with him of late, since he lost to John Cena and had his little feud that ultimately he lost to Randy Orton. I mean, they gave him the win at WrestleMania, but you knew that Orton would get his win back. So they felt they had to do something with Kane, and I think part of it also, the big part of it was, they just did not want to go with another singles match between Punk and Bryan. They didn't trust that people would be interested enough, in spite of the fact that the two of these guys went out there and absolutely tore the house down for 25 minutes at Over the Limit last month and had the best match on the entire freaking show. And it wasn't just like, oh, it was a great match, but the people in the building were sitting on their hands because they thought it was a boring wrestling match. No, the people were going pretty fucking crazy during that match, and there were dueling chants, and it was a great professional wrestling match, and the way that they arranged that finish screamed for a rematch. You know, CM Punk got technically a clean pinfall win over Daniel Bryan, but in a lot of ways, it was a fluky win. It was one of those things where Bryan had something reversed on him, and it was just 3 seconds is all Punk needed to get the pin, but Bryan got Punk to tap out after the bell, and, you know, the one thing was, I loved that finish because I knew, great, we're going to get a rematch. And instead, they gave us a rematch or two between these guys on TV, and they build to the next pay-per-view, not a rematch, let's say, in a cage, being that this is No Way Out, and originally, I thought the idea was that all the main event matches at this pay-per-view would be cage matches. Apparently, it's just going to be the main event. But you could have taken CM Punk and Daniel Bryan and put them in a steel cage for the WWE Championship. I think these two guys would have had a pretty damn good cage match. I said before that Daniel Bryan and Mark Henry, of all people, had a pretty damn good TV cage match on SmackDown last year, to the point where I was begging for a rematch between the two of them. It was actually very enjoyable. Imagine what Punk and Bryan could do in a cage. Well, we're not going to find out. And they've decided, well, we're going to put Kane in there, and we're going to build this entire match, not around the WWE Championship, because you see, the WWE title, it's just not important. If it was important, it would be headlining the pay-per-view. What's important here is, who will AJ side with? And I love the AJ character. The AJ character, she does a tremendous job. She's incredibly cute, very attractive girl. And it's probably the most intriguing character in the company right now. Much like Joseph Park Esquire, I would say, is the most entertaining and intriguing character in TNA right now. And I love that character, and I love that storyline. The AJ stuff has been really good. And the fact that they're building this whole match around her, I can understand why they're doing it. You know, they're building intrigue. Who will she side with? She's a crazy chick. Is she really into Punk? Is it all just a setup for her to help get the title back on her real love interest, Daniel Bryan? Obviously, she's not really interested in Kane, so we could, I think, pretty much disqualify that as a possibility, unless they're going to go with the Sister of Destruction storyline that I pitched way back when, although I don't know that AJ is the right person for that role. But I just think there's something wrong with the idea that they're building this entire match around AJ, and the title itself almost just takes a backseat. This is more of a storyline match than anything else. I don't expect this to be a great match or anything. I think these three guys can have a pretty good match, but we all know, you know, the triple threat formula. You know, one guy gets beaten up so he can lay out, and the other two guys go at it. And I just feel like everybody's going to be looking down that aisleway or looking to AJ if she's at ringside, and they're not going to really care much about what's going on until she gets involved. And you know that AJ is going to get involved. That's really what this whole match is going to be about. You know, as far as who takes the title here, I like the idea of CM Punk going a year with the championship, although if John Cena is going to headline these pay-per-views, it does make more sense for him to have the belt. But I like the idea of a CM Punk year-long or close to a year-long title reign. He's been champion now for what, 7 months? 7.5 months, something like that? In today's day and age, that's pretty impressive. Really, in any era, you know, 7 months is nothing to sneeze at. Even superstar Billy Graham's title reign back in 1978 or 79 wasn't... actually, I'm sorry, 77, I think it was. Was 9 months or something like that. And the CM Punk retain here, you know, my gut tells me that AJ is going to come out in favor of Bryan, and it's all just a setup, and she'll help him win the championship. And you won't get any complaints out of me if Daniel Bryan, of all people, wins the WWE title. But I would keep the title personally on Punk. How you arrange that finish then with AJ, maybe AJ does turn on Punk and reveal her true colors, but it backfires. Just because she turns on Punk doesn't mean Punk has to lose. He could still win. And then you've got Kane. Maybe Kane will factor in there in some way. I guess we'll find out. It's intriguing, but to me, this is not how you handle your top championship. There's just something that's a little off about this to me. But I'm going to go with CM Punk in this match. Sheamus and Dolph Ziggler for the World Heavyweight Championship. What a colossal just clusterfuck this whole situation has been. Originally, it was going to be Sheamus and Alberto Del Rio. And Alberto Del Rio unfortunately suffered a concussion, pretty severe concussion, on SmackDown last week. It was a fluky thing. He hit his head on the WWE sign on the stage, and yeah, he came out later that night and had a match with the Great Khali. I saw on Raw where they tried to pass it off as the injury came from a Khali brain chop, which is comical to me. I suppose if the Great Khali actually did chop you with full force in real life, he would probably kill you. So that is believable, but Khali is... his offense in the ring is anything but believable. So Del Rio is hurt again. Sucks for him. And that left Sheamus without an opponent for the World Heavyweight Championship. Now, mind you, as far as Dolph Ziggler is concerned, Dolph Ziggler, originally, let's take a step back here and see the evolution of this No Way Out card here. Originally, it was going to be Randy Orton and Chris Jericho. That was the feud they were building towards. They did that one angle on Raw where Jericho attacked him after the last pay-per-view, gave him three code breakers and left him laying. And then, of course, Chris Jericho went and he kicked the Brazilian flag. And WWE suspended him. So Jericho was out of the picture, and that left Orton without an opponent. So they do this tease on Raw where Dolph Ziggler finally wants to break out on his own. He knows what he's capable of as a single superstar. He's like, you know, basically he's sick and tired of teaming with this jobber to the stars in Jack Swagger. And he wants to go out on his own, which I am totally in favor of. And they do a tease on Raw where you see Vicky and Dolph backstage watching Orton on a monitor. And they basically tease that this is going to be the replacement match on the pay-per-view. And then Randy Orton goes ahead and gets popped on a wellness violation. Now, supposedly, the story is that it was elevated levels of testosterone that he failed for. So you can, you know, presume on your own what that may be from. So Orton gets suspended for 60 days. He is off the pay-per-view. Dolph Ziggler now has no opponent. Seemed like perhaps they would just slot him in with Swagger, which doesn't do Ziggler any good. And instead, what they have done is they are going to give Dolph Ziggler the ball. I do not expect Dolph Ziggler to win the championship by any means. Certainly possible. I don't expect it. But Dolph Ziggler is, in fact, the number one contender for the world championship. The same Dolph Ziggler that has been jobbed out on virtually every television show before Raw this past Monday night. I think he lost every single match he's had on television. It's just been... he lost a bunch of times to Sheamus already. He just loses and loses and loses. I think he lost to Christian, maybe. And so somehow, this earns you now a shot at the world title. Now, I can't pick on WWE too much, because part of this is just a spate of bad luck that they really didn't have any control over. They didn't tell Jericho to kick the flag. They didn't tell Orton to do something that he shouldn't have done, which he then failed for. They didn't expect Del Rio to get hurt again. So I actually kind of sympathize with them on some level, but I kind of don't. And the reason I don't is because you got a guy like Dolph Ziggler, who's pretty damn good. You know, and I give Dolph Ziggler a lot of love, and I know some people aren't on the Dolph Ziggler bandwagon, and they don't really see what's so special about the guy. But even if you're not into the guy's character, if you don't think he's, you know, world championship level material, you can't deny the fact that Dolph Ziggler's a hell of an athlete. He's a very good professional wrestler. He can bump like nobody else, and it just makes his matches that much more entertaining. He really is, in a lot of ways, the Kurt Hennig of this generation, because that's what Kurt Hennig was known for. He was known for being a guy... he was a great bump taker, but he was a great wrestler who could go in there and carry guys to some very good to great matches, but was never quite viewed, I think, on that top level. He certainly never held a world championship in WWE or WCW. He was an AWA champion in his younger days, but it's kind of eerie in a lot of ways how their careers do mirror each other. And so Ziggler finds himself in a very interesting position here, because clearly he doesn't deserve a shot at the title in storyline, because his character has been portrayed as a loser. And that's WWE's fault. They absolutely deserve flack for that. Because why job this guy out when you know that you have somebody special who has the potential to be so much more at a time when people are getting hurt or they're getting suspended? You have three guys suspended at once, and this supposed... lack of talent, which, you know, not to say that there aren't some very talented young guys, but they're not doing a very good job of pushing many of them. Why you would take one of your most prized performers and make him look like a fool? Because what's going to end up happening, if it hasn't happened already, is people just won't be able to take Dolph Ziggler seriously. Forget his shitty name. If he's a loser, people aren't going to get behind him. People are going to look at this and say, what the fuck is this guy doing in a world championship match on pay-per-view? Why should I care? Sheamus already beat him a whole bunch of times. And if Ziggler does win the title, then what the hell does that say for your world championship? So, anyway, Ziggler can make the most of the opportunity. I think him and Sheamus can... well, we've seen them in the ring. They can have a damn great match. In fact, they may have the best match in the entire show. If it wasn't for Kane... in that triple threat match, I'd give it to Punk and Bryan, and they, you know, they'll probably still have a good match. But I think Sheamus and Ziggler will be the show stealer on this pay-per-view if they give them a little bit of time. But I see Sheamus retaining the world championship, just because the way that they've booked Ziggler, I don't know how you put the title on Ziggler right now. He needs to be rehabbed. You can't just put him in a title match and give him the belt. It just doesn't work. Didn't work for Swagger. Didn't work for Ziggler the first time he was world champion, and I don't think it would work this time either. Christian and Cody Rhodes for the Intercontinental Championship. I'm going to go with Christian in this match. just because I don't see the point in taking the title off him so quickly. They've been playing hot potato with the Intercontinental title. Cody held it for a long time. Big Show won it. Cody got it back. And Christian won it. I'd like to see Christian have some length with it, but it is the Intercontinental title, and so it doesn't really matter. I'll go with Christian. Layla, Beth Phoenix for the Divas Championship. Beth Phoenix, in my opinion, regains the title. I don't even know who's the champion anymore. So I'll go with Beth in that match. You've got Santino Marella. This is a match that was added a couple days ago on WWE.com or on their SMS service. I don't know. It was added online. It will be a tuxedo match between Santino Marella and Ricardo Rodriguez. Good to see that Ricardo at least is getting TV time, even if Alberto is hurt. It's almost scary how much more entertaining Ricardo is than Alberto. Alberto should be the one doing the ring intro for Ricardo. That would be something. Have Ricardo come driving out his beat-up old Datsun every week. So, obviously, this is going to be the bathroom break on the show. It's you know, the comedy match. I don't have a problem with it. It's an undercard match. Nobody's buying the pay-per-view or not buying the pay-per-view based on this match. Both guys are very good in the comedy role, although I wasn't a fan of the Justin Bieber bullshit with the t-shirt they did on Monday. I just didn't find it funny, but you know, it's fine. Nothing wrong with it. A little bit of comedy relief. See, my problem with the comedy in WWE is they rely on it way too much. I don't have a problem with comedy. I don't have any problem laughing. I just don't want to laugh for, you know, 90 minutes of a two-hour show, and, you know, and then they'll wonder why people don't take any of their storylines seriously. David Otunga and Brodus Clay is the pre-show match. I understand. I didn't see it. I understand that Otunga apparently injured Brodus's knee, his ACL, in storyline, and Brodus will soldier on. He will wrestle later today at the pay-per-view in the pre-show YouTube match. I would presume with the injury that means Otunga's going to go over, but who the hell knows? You know, Otunga is an interesting case in that the guy looks like $1 million, and they align him with John Laurinaitis, so he's kind of involved in these main event storylines, and he still jobs to everybody. So, I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do, but I'll go with David Otunga just because I assume they set the Brodus Clay injury up to explain why he will lose. But has Brodus lost a singles match yet clean? I know the Big Show beat him up a couple weeks ago, but that wasn't an official match. Would they really have Otunga become the first person to beat Brodus? I'm not sure about that now. I may have to change my prediction on this. I'll change my prediction to who gives a shit. How about that? And we have Triple H on the show. He is going to appear to address the Brock Lesnar situation and the two pending lawsuits against him and WWE. And, you know, they really haven't done much of anything recently to advance this whole Lesnar-Triple H storyline. We know Triple H is winning at SummerSlam. I think that's pretty much a safe bet. That's still my prediction. What they do tonight, it'll be interesting if Triple H comes out wearing his brace because, you know, Triple H in storyline was supposed to have surgery on his arm, and there's no indication that he's ever had the surgery that he needs. Well, clock is ticking here. SummerSlam, if they're going to do this match, SummerSlam is about 2 months away. I don't know what the hell they're waiting for. So now that Triple H will probably come out, maybe he'll have his brace, maybe now he'll just have a sling, and he'll say, well, my injuries weren't as severe as originally expected, or he'll say that, you know, I'm going to have a minor surgical procedure this week, and I'll be good to go by August, or something like that. I don't know what Triple H is going to say. I know there's a lot of animosity behind the scenes right now towards Brock Lesnar, especially when he showed up at that UFC pay-per-view last month. A lot of people very upset about that. And the match with Triple H is still a go, and I would suspect that we will find out tonight the status of Brock Lesnar in WWE, because if they make a big deal about it, then I would say it's all systems go. And if they kind of downplay it, depending on what Triple H says, that may be a pretty good indicator of where Brock Lesnar stands with WWE right now. So I'm actually very intrigued to see what Triple H has to say on this show. And that's your pay-per-view right there, No Way Out, a very unspectacular show, in my opinion, but what do I know? Speaking of pay-per-views, let's talk about a pay-per-view that was actually pretty damn spectacular. Slammiversary. TNA had their Slammiversary 10 pay-per-view from Arlington, Texas, at the DFW Arena, Depot, whatever the hell it's called. It was on the road. for a change. TNA is always nice when they take the show on the road and they're out of the Impact Zone. And they were in Arlington, Texas for their big Slammiversary show, the 10th one. This is the 10-year anniversary this month of total nonstop action. And say what you want to about TNA, and God knows I have. And the product has been better of late, but the product was complete shit for years and years. And there were a lot of people, myself included, very skeptical that this company would reach a 10-year anniversary. It's not an easy thing to do. A lot of wrestling companies start and stop. They open up, and it doesn't work out. And TNA has been very fortunate to have the backing of a multi-millionaire, if not billionaire, and a network partner with Spike TV, because TV is ultimately whether or not a wrestling organization is successful, truly successful on a national level, depends upon their ability to get a TV deal. And TNA has been very lucky. They've had a very good partner with Spike. And again, as long as Bob Carter keeps pumping in the money and Spike TV continues to support the product, they recently extended the contract for Impact Wrestling for another 2 years, TNA should be on solid footing for the time being. So this was Slammiversary, and I'm going to recap the show here because I did see the pay-per-view, and I actually thought it was one of the best pay-per-views of the year. Not going to lie, this was a very enjoyable show, Slammiversary was. And the pay-per-view started with Hulk Hogan, who was the general manager in TNA. Is another overplayed gimmick in wrestling, the GM. Hogan comes out. We had a great shot of the crowd. The crowd was just really alive all night long, very energetic. Really one of those examples of a crowd having the ability to make a good show great, and in some cases make a bad show good. This was not a bad show, even if it had a dead crowd, it still would have been a pretty good show. But the crowd was jumping. They were hopping. They were excited for this show. And TNA claimed that it was their biggest United States audience ever, which, if that is true, would mean that was probably around 6,000 people. As I said before, they had their first baseball show at the minor league baseball stadium here in Brooklyn about 2 or 3 years ago. I was at that show, and that was the biggest U.S. audience they had ever done, and I believe that crowd was around 5,500, so they had at least that many people in the building, and it looked like it, too. It looked like, you know, the thing about this is it looked and felt like a big-time event. I mean, there are WWE shows and SmackDown tapings, and we've seen pictures of this, that don't get this many people, that look just fucking depressing. And so this looked great. I mean, it made TNA, for the first one of the first times, I guess except maybe when they were in the UK, look really major league. And Hulk Hogan came out. He was beloved. People love seeing the Hulkster. And he introduced the first match on the show, which was Austin Aries and Samoa Joe. Now, before I get to that, let me just mention one other thing here. And that is that Dixie Carter was to have announced on this show the first inductee into the TNA Wrestling Hall of Fame. And she announced Sting as the first inductee. I thought maybe it would be AJ Styles, perhaps Jeff Jarrett, although there was an outside shot of Jarrett, being that the last time we saw him, he was a heel on TV. I thought it would take balls, perhaps, to induct somebody like Randy Savage, which I suppose they still could do, but it was Sting, and you know what? It's hard. I'm surprised I didn't think of that. Sting is actually, in a lot of ways, kind of an obvious choice, and a good one, too. I haven't heard anybody upset over the fact that Sting was announced as the first inductee, or that he was not in some way deserving of such an honor. They aired a great video package for him, which would have been so much better had they been able to use footage of his career in WCW, where he really made his name. You know, if I were TNA, and maybe they did this and they got turned down, I don't know, but instead of asking for Christian Cage, who appeared on this show, instead of asking for Christian to make what really, if you think about it, was a rather meaningless appearance on this pay-per-view. And, you know, maybe he taped some footage backstage for a future DVD. I'm sure he did. But instead of asking for him in exchange for Ric Flair at the Hall of Fame, I would have asked for the rights to use some Sting footage from the WWE video library that they could use in his Hall of Fame video and maybe on a future TNA DVD release of their own. Which I know is very unlikely. I can't imagine WWE allowing any other promotion, let alone their de facto number two, you know, rival promotion to use footage from their tape library, but I would have at least attempted it, because you could have gotten a lot more out of that and being able to use some old Sting footage than just trotting Christian out there for an appearance where it didn't appear to me as though he had a lot of interest in being there. I heard from somebody who worked security backstage at the show who said that he saw Christian, and Christian was mingling with everybody and looked very happy and excited to be there. And I heard the same thing from other people as well who said that Christian was you know, talking with a lot of the guys backstage about how surreal it was that he was there, and he was happy to see everybody, and I'm sure he was, but Christian did not want to make this appearance originally. He actually had to be talked into it by Triple H. He found out months ago, apparently, that he would be the one that, you know, TNA was kind of getting in exchange for them using Ric Flair. And for whatever reason, Christian was adamantly against it. I'm not sure why he would be. I don't think he left TNA on bad terms. And you would think that, in theory, if it's WWE telling him, you have to do this, you wouldn't think that he would fear repercussions. But this is the wrestling industry, you know, where politics are the... kind of the whole story here, and I could see where Christian would honestly think, and I'm not saying this is why he didn't want to do the pay-per-view, but perhaps in his mind he thought to himself, you know what, this sucks, because I've got to show up on a TNA show now, and there's going to be a lot of people talking about it, and if I'm out there and I say good things about TNA, that might be perceived as a slight against WWE, and then I'll be in the doghouse, and they'll job me out, even though they're the ones who asked me to do this. I could see potentially him thinking along those lines, and perhaps that was why he just didn't want to have anything to do with this, because he thought for some reason this could blow up in his face and he can get heat for making an appearance that they booked him for. I could easily see that being the case. But anyway, they didn't ask for the footage, I don't think, and so the video was a little bit barren, missing some of that old Sting footage. But in any event, he appeared to be caught off guard legitimately. He was not expecting the announcement. They did not tell him in advance that he was going to be the first inductee. The fans treated him like a legend. They loved Sting. It was great to see TNA beat WWE to the punch and putting him in the Hall of Fame. It's bizarre to me that Sting has never been inducted, I don't believe, into any wrestling Hall of Fame anywhere of any kind, including WWE. This is his first Hall of Fame induction. And I think he is as deserving as anybody for being as loyal as he has been to that company. And the effort that he puts in now, even at the age of 54, doing dives over the top rope like he did on Impact a couple weeks ago and stuff that he just does not have to be doing. But to put that kind of effort in, you know, working with the younger talent and all of that, I think Sting definitely deserves to be inducted into their Hall of Fame. And Dixie said there would be a formal Hall of Fame induction for Sting as part of the Bound for Glory pay-per-view in October. So perhaps they will announce a few more names between now and then. You know, I think doing an initial Hall of Fame class of three or four people would be fine. I don't know that Sting has to be the one and only person you put in your first year, but, you know, I guess we'll find out. It really hit me when I was watching Sting in the ring accepting this honor and getting all the love and all of the adulation from the fans and from the TNA wrestlers on stage, clapping for him and giving him an ovation. That with all the wrestlers doing that and the reaction he was getting, Sting really should never go to WWE. He belongs in TNA. The Undertaker vs. Sting ship has sailed. It sailed a long time ago. And I'd like to see him personally in the WWE Hall of Fame one day, but he really should end his career in TNA. It just feels right. Just like it would have been weird, I think, for Sting to go to WWE back in the day when he was in WCW, because he was always called the franchise of WCW, which he was in a lot of ways. You know, that's where he made his name, and he worked with all the big names there, and as people would jump ship back and forth, Sting was the one guy who, you know, even if he did consider going to WWE, and I'm sure he did many times, he never did pull the trigger on that. He was always loyal to WCW. And that's the one word I think I will associate with Sting's career, is loyalty. Now, I'm sure Sting was more loyal to the money, and, you know, had WWE offered him a boatload of money at one point that was too hard to resist, he gladly would have jumped ship at some point. There was one time, actually, in 2003, he came very close to coming in, I believe, right around the time of WrestleMania 19, but it didn't work out too well. But Sting just comes across to me as a loyal guy. He was loyal to WCW. He's been loyal to TNA now. It's hard to believe he's been with TNA for, I mean, at least 6 years now, I think it's been. It's a long time. So, I don't know. Just it would feel right to me for him to end his career there. What is to be gained at this point at the age of 54? And he's an okay performer. He's not a great performer. Clearly, he's lost a step. And you could tell with Sting, with his hair, that he's kind of... It's kind of the Ric Flair thing, where Flair's hair would thin out over the years. And it's to the point now, I mean, he doesn't even have that much hair on his head now. But as he got older, Flair's hair would almost become like this... I don't know how to describe, straw-like almost, you know, where the hair would stand up and he would look like Uncle Creepy and all that, and that's starting to happen to Sting. You know, his hair, he's got some long hair on his head, but it's starting to get all stringy and stand up, and he has to keep, you know, brushing it back and everything. He, you know, age is catching up with this guy, and you bring him over to WWE, and I know they can use some main event guys now more than ever, but what are you really going to do with him? You know what I mean? He's got the perfect role right now in TNA. That's just, to me, where he should stay. And I always think back to that one interview where Sting talked about how close he came to signing with WWE after they bought WCW, and how he considered it. He considered coming over, and then he saw that one episode of Raw where The Rock confronted Booker T, who had been a multiple-time WCW champion. And The Rock just pretended like he didn't even know who the guy was. And for Sting, it was a telltale sign of how WWE was likely going to treat most of the WCW guys. And he didn't want to be part of that. And you know what? I commend him for it. He's probably right. Vince McMahon has done some really stupid things for petty reasons. And think about that. That one stupid scripted comment by The Rock may have prevented Sting from coming over to WWE. May have prevented Vince from getting Sting and making money with Sting. Just one little dumb comment is all it took for Sting to go, you know what, if I was considering this, I might have to give this a second thought here, because if this is how they're going to treat the WCW guys, just like an afterthought, I don't want to be part of that. So anyway... That was the Hall of Fame deal. So just to run down the card really quick here, we had Austin Aries and Samoa Joe open the show. This was a great fucking match. They gave these guys about whatever it was, 12, 15 minutes. I think it was less than 15 minutes. But they went in there and had a hell of a match. And I remember when Austin Aries beat Joe for the Ring of Honor title. So, I mean, these guys have a history together. And they're both very good performers. Joe, of course, has kind of fallen off the face of the earth as far as being a singles performer in TNA. And he showed people why, for many years, he was revered by people as being one of the best wrestlers in the world, one of the best wrestlers in the country. He may not have the physique. You may look at the guy and go, what's so special about him? He's a fat guy. He's not just a fat guy. He's a heavy guy who can go in that ring and do things that some guys that are not fat can't do. And they had a great match, and Aries beat him with a very scary-looking brainbuster that looked like he killed Joe. But thankfully, he didn't break his neck. This was a great match. Great, hot match to open the show. The great thing about it was the fans were into it, man. They were chanting Joe. They were chanting for Aries. They were completely into this match. And let it be another example that you don't need two guys that have a name like a... You don't have to take Booker T and Kevin Nash, you know, just because they have names. And you know, think that those are the only people that the fans can get behind. If you take these two young guys that can go in there and kick ass... The fans will get into it. That's how you make stars. And this was great. Kid Cash and Hernandez had a match. I don't know why. These are two guys that I have not seen on TNA television in forever. Especially Kid Cash. He just kind of popped up out of nowhere. But to their credit, these guys had a good match. You know? Not a great match. They had a good match. And Hernandez at one point did this absolutely ridiculous Undertaker dive out of the ring. And Hernandez is a big fucking dude. I don't know how tall he is. He may well be over 6'5". He's a big dude. I actually met him in person once at the first TNA live event I ever went to, which was at Webster Hall many years ago in New York City. And there was a meet and greet that I got as part of the ticket I purchased, and LAX was there, and I met Hernandez. And he's probably even bigger now. He's in better shape now. I will give him that. But a guy that big doing a dive that Kid Cash barely caught him on, too. I thought Hernandez killed himself. Doing this no hands kind of dive over the ropes, and I believe Hernandez won the match. and this was a good match. D-Von and Garrett Bischoff against Robbie E and Robbie T. My bathroom break match of the show, for lack of a better term. From what I saw of it, it was okay. I'm not really into any of these guys. Maybe D-Von a little bit, but yeah, not really a match I was a huge fan of. And D-Von and Garrett got the win, and they did this weird, wacky dance when the match is over that I never have to see them do again. Jeff Hardy, Rob Van Dam, and Mr. Anderson had a three-way dance, a triple threat match, if you will. Winner was to face the champion on Impact. And I think I made a comment on the show in running down the pay-per-view last week where I said that anybody but Mr. Anderson is fine with me. So what happens? Mr. Anderson wins the match. Mr. Anderson does nothing for me. He looks very blah. There's just nothing spectacular about the guy. Say what you want to about, you know, Jeff Hardy. The guy comes out, he's got the wacky look and the wacky eye makeup, and he's flying around the ring. And again, to Jeff's credit, he's gotten himself in shape. I saw Jeff, last year or 2 years ago at the TNA show in Brooklyn at the baseball stadium. And I was in the front row, and Jeff had a match, and he came over to us, and I got a picture with him. He was kind of leaning up against the barricade. I conversed with him for about 30 seconds, and Jeff was carrying a lot of weight. He did not look good. I don't know if it was from, if he was getting off something, and therefore he kind of gained weight. I don't know what his deal was. He was probably doing God knows what at that time. But Jeff Hardy has gotten himself back in shape, looking good, and you know, good for him. But Jeff Hardy would have been a much better choice here. Jeff Hardy is the most over guy probably in TNA, aside from Sting. Sells the most merchandise and all that. You know, he should be probably higher up on the card. I don't know that I'd put the title on him, again, because he certainly, I would say, is still something of a risk. And he doesn't need to have the title on him. Just like I don't think John Cena is somebody who needs the title. But, you know, they didn't go with him. They didn't go with RVD. They went with Anderson. And the match itself was actually pretty good. The match itself was pretty good, so I will say that. Crimson had an open challenge. Crimson has been undefeated, or had been, I should now say, undefeated for 400 and something days. And as he said on Impact, longer than that Goldberg fella. Which probably led a lot of people to think that Goldberg was going to come out here and accept his open challenge. And if you thought that Goldberg was going to come out on this show and accept the open challenge, well, you were probably pretty disappointed when James Storm came out. I wasn't, and the fans in the building weren't. They love seeing James Storm back. He's been off TV for about 2 months. And James Storm is clearly the guy that they're building to get the championship match with Bobby Roode at Bound for Glory. And they put him over like $1 million. The undefeated Crimson is undefeated no longer. James Storm beat him in literally 2 minutes with a super kick. Everybody went crazy. And this was great stuff. This is how you build people up. Gail Kim and Miss Tessmacher, because you can't have more than one Brooke, I guess, in the company, had a match for the Knockouts title. It was okay. It was probably better than most WWE Divas matches you'll see on TV. And Miss Tessmacher won the championship in her home state of Texas. She cried a little bit. It looked like she was crying a little bit when the match was over, and Christy Hemme went over to interview her, and they really tried to make it like a big deal that she won the championship. So this was fine. Joseph Park and Bully Ray had a match. And this was more angle than match. Joseph Park comes out in his tracksuit, pretending that he doesn't know how to wrestle, because in theory, he's just a lawyer. He's an attorney. He's not a wrestler. I mean, his brother, Chris, you know, Abyss. He's a wrestler, but Joseph Park is not a wrestler, and so they tried to play it off. He didn't know how to throw a punch. He was afraid to throw a punch, and at one point he picked up a steel chair to use it on Bully Ray, and he picked it up from the wrong end and was holding it the wrong way, and I can appreciate stuff like that. You know, if you're going to do something like this, you got to do it right, and they did this right. And I see where people were like, oh my god, the match sucked. What the fuck were you expecting with this match? Were you really expecting Joseph fucking Park to go in there and do hurricanranas around the ring and topes and shit? Are you fucking... I mean, how idiotic do you have to be disappointed that this was a bad wrestling match? As though this was going to be, you know, the second coming of, you know, Frank Gotch and George Hackenschmidt or some bullshit like that. Give me a fucking break. This match was fine. This was a very entertaining match. Just like, you know, Santino and Ricardo in the tuxedo match. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but it's on the show for a very specific reason. It's on the show for comedy. It's on the show for entertainment. This match was not a comedy match, per se, but they were advancing a storyline. A storyline, mind you, that is probably my favorite storyline in all of wrestling right now, is this whole Joseph Park character. He is so goddamn good doing this character, and I posted a video on my Facebook page of TNA has this show that they're doing, I think, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, like three times a week on their website. It's on YouTube, called TNA Today, in a little mock studio hosted by Jeremy Borash. And there's an episode of TNA Today that's up right now, about 17 minutes long, where he interviews Joe Park Esquire via some sort of Skype video link. The quality is of the connection that he has with Joe Park actually sucks. He probably really was hooked up via Skype or something doing the interview. But it's great stuff. I mean, it's entertaining as all hell. And Joe Park is just hilarious. You got to watch that video if you didn't watch it. And he's just so good at being that lawyer character that when the day comes that he stops doing the character and they reveal that him and Abyss are in fact one and the same, I'm going to be very disappointed. In fact, I hope that when the day comes that they do the reveal, he just continues to portray both characters anyway, because he's crazy. He's nuts. We've always known that Abyss is crazy. I think he can still do both characters even after you reveal that they are in fact the same person. I would gladly watch Joseph Park on TV every week and not Abyss. I mean, Abyss, back in the day as this monster character, was great. I think you could have brought him in for a feud with The Undertaker. But to me, the Abyss character is so played out. It's kind of like Big Show in WWE. He's gone back and forth, heel and face, so many times. He's been the giant. He's been the comedy character. Remember when him and he got the magical powers from Hulk Hogan's Hall of Fame ring? What complete bullshit that was. So he's gone back and forth with the Abyss character so many times, and now he portrays this character that is just so much better. You know, Bradshaw for so many years was the beer-drinking, kind of kick-ass member of the APA, and he was very good in that role. And then he had a character transformation. And he came out on SmackDown one week with the cowboy hat, all elitist, and we saw for the first time John Bradshaw Layfield. And he knocked it out of the park with that character. He was a great, awesome heel. The JBL character was great. Sometimes you just have this career renaissance where, you know, you kind of get a second life portraying a different character, and I think that's what we have here with Joe Park. He's just this lovable, affable guy that people can get behind. And I've seen other people point out the fact that when they're in the Impact Zone in Orlando, or even here at the pay-per-view, which was in Texas, completely different crowd, it's not like you have people in the crowd that are kind of heckling him or shouting, you know, Abyss, or, you know, you're Abyss, or it's like you don't get that. People, and I have to believe that people know that they are one and the same. I'm sure there are people who don't, which is kind of scary. By now, if you don't know that they're one and the same, then I just don't know what to say. I don't know what that says about wrestling fans if, you know, after doing the character for so many months, you haven't figured it out yet. But the people are into it. You know, they're not turning on it. They're not heckling him. They're not chanting things that they shouldn't be chanting, which you see all the time on WWE TV with the fans. But that's what's great about this. And they had a match. Bully Ray beat him up. He got some shots in on Bully Ray. They did the thing where somebody came out from under the ring wearing an Abyss outfit. Apparently it was one of the students from the Team 3D Wrestling Academy. His back was to the camera, so at no point did the people on TV actually see this person's face. We presume it was Abyss. He put Bully Ray through a table with a choke slam, went back under the ring, and then Joe Park, who himself had crawled under the ring, comes back out, although he comes out so quickly that it's impossible to believe that he would have been able to undress as quickly as he did. So he comes back out from under the ring, sees Bully Ray laid out, pins him, and wins the match. You've never seen a person so happy. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because in the next match, the tag team titles, which I'll get to in a second, Kurt Angle looked ecstatic to win the championship in that match. But Joe Park was elated to come out of this match victorious, as were the people. This was very enjoyable. And Bully Ray is also very good in his role. I've said that before as well. For him to go to WWE at this point, I think would be a mistake, just because I don't see WWE allowing Bully Ray to be the Bully Ray character that he is in TNA. And a watered-down version of Bully Ray would just not work. He's perfect in the role that he's in now. And I could easily see him holding the world title at some point. I really could. We had a tag team match. Christopher Daniels and Kazarian defending their tag titles against AJ Styles and Kurt Angle. And this was an awesome match. This was a great tag team match. A lot of crazy stuff, particularly at the end of this match. And Kurt Angle ends up getting Kaz to tap out to the ankle lock. The only thing I didn't like about this was, and it's a nitpick, but watching it from the angle that it was shot from on pay-per-view, it looked like Kazarian could easily grab the bottom rope. He was like he was way too close to the ropes. He should have at least pretended like he couldn't reach, or Angle should have pulled him back a little bit more. It kind of sort of killed the finish for me a little bit, just because it's like, dude, grab the fucking rope. You're right there. And he tapped out instead. And Kurt Angle went nuts. He was just so happy to be the tag team champions. And which is a good way, by the way, to get the title over. Just like in the Knockouts match when they interviewed Tessmacher when it was over, and it felt kind of special that she had won the title. And it was a special thing to her to win it in her home state. So Angle and AJ were very happy to win the tag team titles. And this was the best match on the entire show, even more so than Aries and Joe, which was also a great match in its own right. So right off the bat, you go into the main event, you don't know what you're going to get with Sting, but you've got two awesome matches on this pay-per-view and a bunch of good ones. So that automatically makes Slammiversary a thumbs up at that point. And the main event, you had Bobby Roode defending the TNA title against Sting. And they had a match that was not that great. You know, they had a lumberjack match on TV a few weeks back that was probably better than this. It was fine. I mean, it was okay. I did like the finish. I thought it was a clever way to kind of bring things back around to the whole Bobby Roode, James Storm thing. When Storm was out earlier in the pay-per-view, after he beat Crimson, he celebrated with some beer. He had a six-pack of beer bottles at ringside that apparently were still left there even after he departed. And so, at one point at the end of this match here, Bobby Roode sees the beer outside the ring when he's brawling with Sting, and he grabs the beers, brings them into the ring. He tries to use a beer bottle on Sting, and the referee stops him and goes to throw the beer bottle away. And when he does that, Roode grabs another bottle from the six-pack case and smashes Sting in the head with the beer bottle. And he pins Sting, 1-2-3. And it's funny because you can clearly, it's one of the more obvious blade jobs that I've seen in quite some time. When Bobby Roode pins Sting, as soon as the ref counts three, you can see Sting slicing himself open to get some color. So Bobby Roode retains the championship. Sting attacks him after the match, beats him up. They brawl up the aisleway onto the stage. And they do this spot where Sting gives him, I think it was a Scorpion Death Drop, actually, off the stage. And unfortunately, Sting kind of, he fell a little too far. And there was a crash pad. So obvious, there was a crash pad down below. And Sting's head hit either the pavement or some metal lighting structure or something, but unfortunately he bashed his head pretty good, busted himself open on the back of the head. There was a funny moment here, though, because, and I heard this with headphones on, so I don't know if this would if this came across to everybody or not. You might have to be listening with headphones really closely, but when they did that spot and they landed and Sting hit the back of his head, you can hear him lean over to Bobby Roode and say, "I hit my head," and then Roode mutters back to him, "Me too." Because I think Bobby Roode's head also may have overshot the crash pad, and he may have hit the floor. And they're lucky they don't have two guys with concussions. Or maybe they do. I mean, I don't know that TNA has the same sort of testing. Ironically, the testing that WWE has for concussions is called impact testing. I don't know that TNA has that. Maybe they both got concussions, for all I know. But it could have been a lot worse. I just thought, though, it was a nice little moment there between the two guys, and you know, Sting's like, "Oh, I hit my head," and Bobby's like, "Yeah, me too." It's like that. So, Slammiversary was a great pay-per-view. It was probably the best pay-per-view, the best wrestling pay-per-view of the year, I would say, behind Extreme Rules. I still think Extreme Rules was a better show, and that spectacle of Brock Lesnar and John Cena in the main event is going to be hard to top. WrestleMania, I'm biased just because I was there, so obviously I thought it was a great show. Had I been watching WrestleMania at home on pay-per-view, I'm not quite sure I would have graded it as high as I do. But if you take WrestleMania out of the equation, since I am biased in that respect, Slammiversary was a hell of a show. And the first TNA pay-per-view that I have watched, top to bottom, I didn't skip any matches. The first TNA pay-per-view that I have watched, top to bottom, in a long-ass time. And I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And that seems to be the pattern right now, is that TNA has had quite the turnaround from the way they were even 6 months ago. Vince Russo is gone, and the product improves. It's funny how that works. But TNA just is, they're just firing on all cylinders right now. It's not perfect, but they've got some momentum here. The ratings don't bear it out just yet, although the ratings for the new time slot, they are creeping back up to normal levels, which is good. Although my fear is that normal levels are not enough. And this live impact experiment is just that. It's an experiment. And if they don't get the numbers up higher to justify the added cost of going live every single week, by mid-August, I think the deal for them to go live is not literally not for the entire summer. I think it goes through the middle of August. And at that point, Impact will probably go back to being taped. And taped versus live at the end of the day, I mean, I think I've talked about that on the show before. Clearly, it doesn't really make much of a difference in terms of the ratings. You would think that being that the Impact results are not floating around the internet for weeks in advance, the numbers would be higher, but they're really not. But there is an element to the show being live that just makes it feel more, spontaneous, unpredictable, maybe, for lack of a better term. The funny thing is, I've only seen one live Impact so far. I've seen Impact the last 3 weeks. Technically, the only live show I've seen is the first one, because the last two Thursdays I've been busy. And with my newfound DVR, I've DVR'd the show, so technically I've seen Impact taped over the last 2 weeks. But Impact is just a much better show than Raw. And there's just no way around it, you know. And I'm going to talk about both shows briefly here. I don't want to spend too much time going through every segment. Raw on Monday night, which I'll get to after. I'm going to talk about Impact first. But I just have to say that Raw, you look at Raw on Monday night, and that was a show that was painful to sit through. There's just no other way to describe it. 3 hours is too fucking long for Raw to be every single week. You want to do a 3-hour show every now and then, go ahead. Because at the end of the day, if it's a shit show, you're complaining about one long shit show, and then they go back to being 2 hours the next week. If what we saw Monday night is any indication of what we're going to be in for starting July 23rd, it's going to be... these Monday nights are going to be very long. Let's just put it that way. I can't sit through 3 hours of Raw every week. I just can't. If the shows are going to be anything like they were this week, there's no way I'm going to be able to do it. I'll do it the first couple of weeks, and after that, I don't know. It's just not fun. Raw is not fun. I want it to be fun. I think that July 23rd show will probably be pretty fun. I'm sure they'll bring back a whole bunch of old faces, but that doesn't really solve anything, you know? It's a special occasion, so I guess you can bring back whoever you want to bring back, but... you know, those guys are not going to be on TV every week. And what they're doing with their current crew of guys right now is not good. It's just really not good. And Impact is a very enjoyable wrestling show. It's really quite bizarre. It's Bizarro World. WWE likes to use that term, Bizarro World. Well, I feel like I'm living in Bizarro World right now. I never thought I'd see the day where I rave about Impact, watch an entire pay-per-view, love it, and think that Raw is just consistently shit. It's one of those things where Raw is so inconsistent. I would expect that 1 week it would be shit, and the next week it would be awesome. I can't remember the last really good or awesome Raw show. It's been 3 or 4 straight weeks, I think, now, of complete bullshit. With some good things sprinkled in. Not every segment is terrible, but the show sucks. And, you know, they're going to go 3 hours, and it's not going to help. I would only imagine it's going to hurt. And now there's news of the new season of NXT actually airing on WWE.com after all, which I think originally they were not going to do that. If that's the case, it's kind of funny that maybe in a situation here where my new favorite wrestling shows every week, as far as my priority viewing, would be Impact and NXT. And Raw may slip to number 3 on that list. It's just very, very weird how things work out. Let's talk about Impact. Impact was the better wrestling show of the week. The show opened up with an Ultimate X match for the X Division Championship between Austin Aries, Zema Ion, and Chris Sabin. And the one thing about this show that I will say that I thought was overkill, I thought it was overkill to have on one show, and it wasn't a pay-per-view, just a regular Impact, to have an Ultimate X match, a Royal Rumble, and a world title match, I think is a little bit too much to have on one show. And I know why they would probably want to do it. They're trying to get the ratings up, and they want to give people a reason to tune in. But you're going to have a lot of more live Impacts between now and August. And I just think having all three of those things on one show is probably a bit too much. But again, a minor point to make. They had this Ultimate X match, and it was okay. I don't really think it was a great match, to be honest with you. And not just because of the Sabin injury. I just didn't think it was really all that great of a match. I thought it was just, they wanted to start with, you know, the show with a gimmick to get people to tune in, and that was really the only purpose that it served. And unfortunately, the other purpose that it served was an injury purpose, in that Chris Sabin got hurt in being backdropped over the top rope at one point by Austin Aries, and it was, you know, a regular spot. It wasn't like he was doing a crazy, wacky flip dive or anything like that. But just the way he landed on his leg, on his knee on the outside, he suffered an injury that has since been diagnosed as a torn ACL in his left knee. And this really sucks, because Chris Sabin, of course, has been out for a long time. I mean, he only recently came back to TV, and he was gone for, I don't know if it was a year, close to a year. He was out for many, many months after he tore his right ACL in his knee and needed to have it operated on. So essentially, it sounds like he just suffered the exact same injury in his other knee. So that would indicate to me that he's probably going to be out for another 6 to 8 months at least. And that really blows. That really sucks. I just... it's kind of like when Triple H tore his quad the second time. Say what you want to about Triple H. I don't wish injury or ill upon anybody. Tearing your quad probably hurts like a motherfucker. And I respect the hell out of Triple H for, you know, gutting through the injury in that one match on Raw and finishing the match and going through the rehab and all that stuff to come back. He came back 8 months later. But he tore his other quad in his good leg, you know, back in 2007. And just imagine if you're Triple H, having already gone through this injury in your other leg, and knowing the rigorous rehabilitation that one must endure, and probably the pain that one must endure, to heal an injury like that and then make a comeback. And it takes as much mental willpower, I'm sure, as it does physical willpower to get through something like that, and to know what's expected of you, and to finally kind of persevere and put the injury behind you, and then a couple years later, you tear the quad in your other leg. And it's like, oh, God, now I got to go through all of that rehab again and to look at the road ahead and know exactly what you have to go through. It's probably just very deflating, I would imagine. And that's probably what Chris Sabin is going through right now. He is determined to come back. He is optimistic that he will be back. But, you know, two ACL tears in both knees is not a good thing. And you could tell right away that it wasn't a worked injury. I saw where some people were like, oh, maybe it was part of the match. But I knew right away only because I saw the expression on his face, and he tried to come back in. He came back in, and he really didn't do much. He kind of threw a couple of weak, half-hearted punches at Aries, and then he just kind of dropped down and rolled out of the ring, and it just didn't serve any purpose if it was an angle, so I pretty much figured he was fucked at that point, and unfortunately, that was the case. But Aries wins, retains his X Division title that he has held now for a long, long time, and then he had a promo after the match. And Hulk Hogan came out. So imagine, you know, a couple weeks ago on Impact, they aired a segment from backstage where Hulk Hogan made Taz the official third judge in the Gut Check Challenge. And I think I commented that it was bizarre just to see Hulk Hogan and Taz standing there having a face-to-face discussion backstage. And this also felt the same way, having Hulk Hogan in the ring to confront Austin Aries. Think about Austin Aries and where he was a year ago. Austin Aries, for the benefit of those of you who aren't aware, had applied to be on the WWE relaunched version of Tough Enough that debuted after WrestleMania last year. And Austin Aries, I think, had made the final cut as picked by the people at the production company who were putting the show together. I don't know if it was the production company or USA Network, but they wanted Aries to be one of the people on the show because they saw a guy who probably had personality, excuse me, and all that, but was also a pretty goddamn good wrestler. And what ended up happening is when Kevin Dunn and the production people in WWE got a hold of the list of people that the production company had chosen to be on the show, they basically said, no. This is not acceptable. They saw a list that was full of indie guys, and they didn't want that. They wanted the show to be full of people that were, you know, I'm sure good-looking, and people that didn't necessarily have a whole hell of a lot of wrestling experience. You know, they had Matt Cross. There were people who had previous wrestling training. Matt Cross may have been the only real name indie guy on the show, and ironically, he was, I think, the second guy booted off the show. Because Trish Stratus, of all people, deemed that Matt Cross didn't have a personality or some bullshit like that. As if Trish Stratus should be in the position of determining stuff like that. Give me a fucking break. But anyway, Aries was on the original list of people who was supposed to be on Tough Enough, and then he got cut from that list because he was an indie fool, I guess, and they didn't want him on there. And he was very down after that happened. I think there were some cryptic tweets about, you know, teasing that maybe his time in wrestling was coming to an end and it was time to hang it up or change careers or do something like that. And then TNA gave him a chance. And he had already been in TNA before, many, many years ago, as Austin Starr. They wouldn't let him be Austin Aries, which was his name in Ring of Honor, so he was Austin Starr. And had some success, and then I think had a falling out or something happened, and he left TNA, went back to ROH. And now they let him back as Austin Aries, as himself, and he's been kick-ass in the ring. He's had consistently has great matches. He is one of the more over-personalities in the company. A small guy, which has worked against him, I'm sure, for a large part of his career, and probably worked against him with the Tough Enough thing as well, was his size. But he's done well in TNA. And Hulk Hogan, of all people, is just heaping praise on him. At one point, Hogan made a comment about how Austin Aries is like the most amazing performer that he's ever seen step foot inside the ring, which you can look at it from two different perspectives. You can look at it from the perspective of, wow, Hulk Hogan just put Austin Aries over like $1 million. That's pretty cool. On the other hand, I just couldn't help but think when Hogan said that, like, you're so full of shit. You are so full of shit because there's no way that people believe that Hulk Hogan honestly thinks that Austin Aries is the best performer he's ever seen step foot inside the ring because he's not. And for Hulk Hogan to say it, I don't know. I feel like he can put Aries over a million different ways. You could say, you know what, Austin Aries, I gotta be honest with you, brother. You are by far one of the most, if not the most talented guy that I've seen come through the curtain at TNA in a long time. And you, my friend, have the potential to be as big a star as you want to be. If he would have said something like that, it would have been believable. But, I don't know, the minute he said that you're the best thing I've ever seen in the ring, it's like, really, with all the people that you've been in the ring with, and Hogan's been around for a million years, Austin Aries is the best, and give me a break. I didn't believe that Hogan believed what he was saying, because he didn't. It was bullshit. But anyway, he still put him over, and what's interesting about this is, he basically said, Aries has a decision to make, because Aries wants to move up the ladder. He wants, basically, the world championship. He feels he's ready. He's at that level. So Hogan said, I'll give you a match with Bobby Roode at the next pay-per-view. But you will have to give up the X Division title. You can't be the X Division champion while you fight for the world championship. And I thought this was a very clever angle. It's a very, it builds intrigue. What will his decision be? Obviously, I presume he will give up the title and will go for the championship and not win it. Which is the trade-off here. The trade-off, as Hogan said, is that you can give up the X Division title and I will give you a crack at Bobby Roode's World Championship, but if you lose that match, you have nothing. You don't have the world title and you no longer have your X title. So it's an interesting decision for Austin Aries to make. He teased that he was giving him 7 days to make up his mind, and on Impact Live this Thursday night, we will find out for sure whether or not Austin Aries is going to challenge for the World Championship at the next pay-per-view. I think this is great. It builds the match up, if in fact they are going to have a match. Makes it feel special. Austin Aries is over. Bobby Roode is hated. And it just makes things feel important. You know, he's got a very important decision to make. What will his decision be? Part of me almost hopes he doesn't accept, just because you have a chance here to make that X Division title even, you know, more meaningful than it is now by having Austin Aries say, you know what, Hulk, I thought long and hard about what you said to me last week, but this title here means more to me than anything right now. I've worked hard. I've worked my ass off to be the X Division champion, and I'll be damned if, you know, I'm going to give it up or kind of lose it without really losing it or something like that and say, you know what, I have enough faith in my ability to know that my time is going to come no matter what. The cream always rises to the top or something like that. And then turn down the opportunity to wrestle for the world title. I don't think he'll do that, but you certainly could make the X Division title be even more special if you wanted to go in that direction. So this was good. I like this. I like this, what they did here a lot, actually. We then had a segment, again, Joseph Park and Bully Ray. Bully Ray obviously very upset that Abyss cost him the match at the pay-per-view, and Joe Park was backstage and in catering. He was bragging to people about his big win. He's so fucking great. So this was good. D-Von and Hernandez had a match. It was what it was. Nothing special. D-Von won. There was a funny moment at one point where Hernandez climbed to the top rope, and it looked like the ropes were wet, maybe. It looked like either, I don't know what it was, it looked like the rope was wet. He could not get a grip with his foot on the rope. And he finally managed to jump off, but it was it didn't look good. Didn't get a lot of oomph behind his dive off the top rope, so that was about the only fuck-up in the match, really. It was okay. We had Dixie Carter and AJ Styles at various points during the show were shown interacting backstage, and this is the other big storyline at TNA right now, that they've got some sort of secret that next week they're going to come out with it, they're going to reveal to the world. And Dixie at one point made a comment later in the show. She said, you know, people are going to get hurt, but we just have to come out with it. We can't keep it a secret anymore. So apparently the big twist in the AJ-Dixie storyline is going to be revealed on Impact next week. So again, what they've done here is to build up the next live Impact, they now have two separate storylines, two separate angles that are kind of like cliffhangers, meant to get people to tune in because they're curious what's going to happen. What will Austin Aries' decision be? And what will the big secret be with AJ and Dixie? They're building this up remarkably well, I have to say. And I don't know where they're going with the AJ-Dixie storyline, and I like that. I like that I don't know what they're going to do with it. I'd rather not know, quite frankly, until it actually happens. They had the Bound for Glory series that they kicked off this week. The Bound for Glory series last year, I will admit, maybe it's just because I wasn't as into TNA then as I am now, but very difficult for me to follow. They would put these leaderboards up on the screen back then with everybody had different points. I think Crimson had more points than anybody else, and yet Crimson didn't even win the frickin' tournament. He got, I think, taken out with an injury at one point, which was kind of a cop-out. But the guy with the most points, you didn't want to beat him. You wanted to keep him undefeated, so you had somebody clip his knee or something backstage. I thought that was kind of dumb. But it just didn't make sense to me how many points people had, and it was very confusing to me. And so they're doing the Bound for Glory series again, where it's 12 guys, and at the end, one guy, the winner with the most points, will get a championship match at Bound for Glory, which apparently is their WrestleMania of pay-per-views every year. So they've started the build to their big show of the year. And I went on the TNA website. Apparently, as far as how the points work for this whole thing now, everybody will have a match with everybody in this tournament. You get 10 points for a submission win. You get 7 points for a pin. You get 5 points for a count out. 3 points for a DQ win. 2 points for a draw. Of course, you get nothing for a loss. And if you get disqualified and lose, you lose 10 points. So that's kind of the system for this thing here. One thing that they're doing, which I think they did last year as well. As a matter of fact, I know they did it last year because... was it the show that I went to? I went to one of the TNA shows last year. Actually, I don't think it was. I think they had a show in Asbury Park in New Jersey the next night. And at that house show, I mean, they would have Bound for Glory series matches on the road at house shows. So you've got these matches at these live events that actually do mean something. They have an impact, no pun intended, on what you will see on television. And they're doing that again this year, and I think it's a great idea. It's like having a title change at a house show every now and then. You do it to shake things up a little bit, but you also do it because you want people to think that, you know what, if I'm going to buy a ticket to go to a live event and there's not going to be any TV cameras there, or, you know, it's not going to be live on the air, who cares? You know what? You have a tag title change or an intercontinental title change or even a world title change every now and again, and it makes people think, huh, you never know what you're going to get. Maybe I'll see a title change at the next show that I go to. And WWE will do that every now and then, like tag titles will change hands or something like that. And the problem I have with them is that normally when they do that, and they don't do it often enough, they don't bother showing footage of it on TV. So it's kind of like, what's the purpose? You know, you should have that footage all queued up at the beginning of the show before your intro, showing that, you know what, last night in Sioux City, whatever, South Dakota or whatever, you know, you show footage of these people winning the championship belts or something like that. It just makes it feel more important. So I like the idea of having Bound for Glory series matches at house shows. And they're going to have TV cameras there. They'll show footage of it on Impact, and they'll put the leaderboards back up and all that. So people like that sort of thing. You know, people like, it's like when I pitched the idea on Sound Off 27 of, what was it, 26, I think it was. No, I'm sorry. It was episode 127 of the Sound Off, when I did my whole WWE business overview and if I were in charge, things I would do and ideas that I would implement. And one of them was some sort of power ranking system where you go on WWE.com, and they could also flash them on TV on the actual shows. But you have a top 10 for your world championship, and you have a top 5 list of contenders for all of the other titles. Top 5 for the IC, top 5 for the tag team, although, you know, with the number of tag teams they have, it should probably be a top 3. But you have it so people can follow along and know exactly who is in line for a title shot. And, you know, if there's somebody on your list who's number 7 in contention for the world title, and you really want to bump them up to number 1 or number 3, so you book a match on TV. You shoot an angle, and you book a match. You say, all right, you guys want to face each other, no problem. The number 7 guy is going to face the number 3 guy. And if the number 7 guy wins, you guys are going to switch spots. Yeah, you can move people up and down like that if you want somebody to challenge for the title. At least there's a meaning behind it. But people love that shit. They love to go online and or on their smartphone or whatever and see a chart with rankings of people and where they are and their statistics or their win-loss record and stuff like that. People want to be involved. So that's what I like about this idea personally, and it makes Bound for Glory feel special. So it would appear that it's obvious where they're going with this. James Storm won the Battle Royal, by the way, which gave him a 20-point head start in this series on everybody else, which seems almost insurmountable, but it's really not. Because if James Storm loses a match or two and somebody goes on a win streak and gets, you know, 10 points for a submission win, you know, they can catch up to him pretty quickly. But James Storm was in the Battle Royal, Royal Rumble. They call it a gauntlet match. I guess a gauntlet match in TNA is their version of a Royal Rumble. And they had 11 guys. Pope, D'Angelo, De Niro, out of nowhere, made his comeback to TNA. He just showed up. They said that he's been busy making movies and stuff, which is true. He's got a very minor bit part in the new Batman movie, actually, that's coming out in a month, which I'm very excited about, by the way, the Dark Knight Rises. So that is true. I don't know what other entertainment stuff he's supposedly been doing, but the Dark Knight thing, he shot that months ago. So I don't know what he's been doing in the meantime. But he was in there. Daniels was in there, and AJ and Kurt, and James Storm, I mentioned. A bunch of other people. Bully Ray. And Kazarian was not. I figured Kazarian would be in there if Daniels was, but apparently Kazarian was wrestling at that time at a TNA house show that they had booked the same night, which seems kind of ludicrous to me, but I assume that was just the house show that TNA booked before they were told that they were going to go live every single Thursday night. So imagine what you must have been like if you were in the crowd at that show, that TNA house show that was going on at the same time that Impact was live. I mean, that must have been a skeleton crew that they had. I think it was Kazarian, Matt Morgan, and Crimson had a match, I think, and they had the women doing stuff. That must have been a pretty, I don't want to say it was a pretty shitty house show because I wasn't there, Maybe they had fun with it, but they didn't have a lot of top names for that show. But that's where Kazarian was and why he was not on the TV show this week. So Samoa Joe was also in there. He got super kicked off the apron by James Storm. And there you go. James Storm wins the gauntlet match. He cut a promo when it was over that was fucking great. If you didn't see it, go online and find it. This was great stuff. We had Miss Tessmacher defending her newly won Knockouts Championship against Madison Rayne. And this was okay. Nothing special. About a two-minute match, but Tessmacher retains. Brooke Hogan met backstage with Gail Kim. I see where some people have torn Brooke Hogan to shreds. They said that she was terrible in this segment. And to me, I say I thought she was fine. I didn't see anything wrong with her in this segment. I think Brooke is... it's interesting, because Brooke is very... She's very well-spoken, you know? Speaking-wise, in the appearances... She's only made a few appearances so far. This was her second backstage one. But I thought she was fine. I just think she carries herself well. I think they're protecting her by limiting her, so far, only to backstage segments and not in front of the live crowd, who may not be as kind to her. That'll be interesting when they start trotting her out in front of the live audience. How she does out there, number one, and number two, how the fans react to her. But I didn't see anything wrong with this segment. Basically, Gail Kim was being a bit of a bitch to her and telling her that I deserve my rematch for the Knockouts title. This was after Brooke had announced that she was going to sign, I think, a four-way match of some kind, and Gail told her that not so fast. I have a rematch built into my contract. And Brooke said, you're correct. You do get a rematch, but you get a rematch when I say you get a rematch. And so she basically said that you can go on vacation. You won't be part of the four-way. And that was that. So actually, both women were being kind of bitchy to each other, which hopefully does not mean they're going to have a match. But I thought this was fine. There was nothing wrong with this. Mr. Anderson and Bobby Roode for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. And there could not be a main eventer, I think more so in either TNA or WWE than Mr. Anderson, who I just don't give a shit about. He does not really inspire much excitement, to me anyway. And him going around calling himself an asshole and all this, I mean, I know TNA is not PG, nor do I advocate a PG direction. I think, they're fine as they are, allowing some salty language. But I don't know, just him saying asshole over and over again, do we really need that? Really? Come on. But I don't know. Anderson, to me, in the main event just doesn't do a whole lot. And this was great. This was great because Bobby Roode beat Mr. Anderson clean with his submission hold with a crossface at the end of the match. He was working over the arm. He put him on in the crossface once. It didn't work. I think Anderson reversed it or something. And he got him back in the hold. And Mr. Anderson, the valiant babyface, tries to reach for the ropes and is unable to do so. His arm has been savagely beaten by Bobby Roode, and he's been put in this painful submission hold, and he is left with no choice but to tap out. There was no outside interference. There was no beer bottle to the head. There was no rake to the eyes, low blow, hooking the trunks. It was clean as a sheet, and the evil villain beats the babyface with his submission hold and looks strong in the process, and Bobby Roode retains his championship, thank Christ. Not that I thought they were going to put the title on Anderson, but you never know. And for that reason alone, this was good. That finish right there made this match, to me, tolerable. Because otherwise, it was just kind of there. Not a particularly great match. And then the end of the show, we had Sting come out. They had showed the Hall of Fame video for Sting, and he came out, and he started thanking people again. I'm not quite sure why. This was not his actual induction, but he came out, he thanked the fans, he thanked Jerry Jarrett and Jeff Jarrett and the Carters, and all of a sudden, three guys in ski masks came out. they were covered pretty much from head to toe. They had these vests, and they were wearing jeans, and they had the masks on, and they just started beating Sting up. And I could have sworn that at Slammiversary on Sunday before, you had an entire roster of TNA talent on that stage applauding Sting, showing their respect for Sting, and in the video package, they're talking about how much they respect him, and they love Sting, and Sting is part of the fabric of TNA and all of this stuff, and here's Sting getting his ass beaten by these three unknown individuals. I mean, for all we know, these three guys are not even TNA stars. I presume they're not. Maybe they're hired guns from an existing TNA star. Maybe they're just maybe they're from a rival wrestling company. Who knows? But it made no sense for nobody to come out and help Sting. I mean, they went to black. They faded to black on this show, and these guys were still beating the fuck out of Sting, and the show was over. They were putting the boots to him. Not one person came out to help Sting. So they better have a damn good explanation for that on TV next week, because that's pretty damn incompetent right there, as far as, you know, it just doesn't make sense. It wouldn't make sense anyway, I don't think, even if Sting hadn't gone into the Hall of Fame and had all the, the video package and everything. But it made it worse, again, just because you had everybody out there on stage paying their respects, everybody in that video talking about what a great performer and a great person. You had Crimson, for God's sakes, who's been a heel now for a few months on TV in this video package now, talking about what a great person Sting is. He's gotten to befriend him backstage and everything, and I guess Sting is friendly with them, but not friends enough to anybody on the TNA roster to where they would lift a finger to come out and help the poor guy. So that was kind of dumb. But again, another cliffhanger. Who were these three guys, and why were they beating up Sting? You know, this story may turn out to be pretty dumb, or maybe not. I have no idea who these people were supposed to be, who they actually were played by. I don't know. But that's three reasons that TNA gave you now to tune into Impact next week. To find out what happened to Sting and who the masked men were, to find out what the big reveal is in the AJ Dixie storyline, and to find out what Austin Aries' decision will be and if he will sacrifice the X Division title to contend for the World Championship against Bobby Roode. Three reasons they gave their fans on this two-hour show to tune in next week. And it was all great. The way they did it, I don't know where it leads, but the way they did it was great. And I am actually interested. I am anxious to watch Impact this Thursday night. I cannot say the same thing for Raw. I am not going to go segment by segment on this show because it would be too painful for me to do that. I will start by saying that there was some good on Raw this past Monday night. Raw was a three-hour show, by the way, from Hartford, Connecticut. And on this show, Dolph Ziggler and Christian had a nice match within a match. They were part of a larger four-way that included Jack Swagger and the Great Khali. Why the Great Khali is still wrestling is a question I ask myself every week. I still haven't been given a good answer. Thankfully, they got rid of him early. He was the first person eliminated in that match, a match that he shouldn't have been in to begin with. When it got down to Ziggler and Christian, it was only a couple of minutes, but it was really, really good. And the good thing about this, you know, much like I just mentioned the Bobby Roode, Mr. Anderson thing on Impact, is that when it was all over, Ziggler beat Christian clean. There was no outside interference from Swagger or Vicky or Cody costing Christian the match or anything like that. It was Dolph Ziggler outsmarting Christian and beating him and getting the 1-2-3 and earning himself the right to meet Sheamus at the pay-per-view for the World Heavyweight Championship. And I commend WWE at least for putting Ziggler in the match, even though, again, it would be nice if they hadn't beaten this poor guy down and made him look like a jobber on TV for weeks and weeks. He loses to everybody. But they were they've been snake-bitten lately with these injuries and all the other stuff, and they almost had no choice, quite frankly, because if you don't put Ziggler in there, then who the hell do you put in that match? Kane is already tied up with the WWE title stuff. So I see some people were like, well, they could have put Cody in that match, but Cody already has a match with Christian, and Cody was in Turkey. He wasn't even on Raw. He was in Turkey doing PR, so he wasn't available. So it was really the only person, if you think about it, that made sense was Dolph Ziggler. I feel like Dolph Ziggler is like that kid in the when you're not very talented, which he is, but the kid who's not very talented, either really scrawny or really fat, who's standing there waiting to be picked for dodgeball, you know, and you have your two team captains and they kind of point, I want you on my team. Okay, I pick you. And Dolph is like that kid that would be the last one left. And they finally look at him and they go, all right, I guess there's nobody left. I'll pick you. Which sucks because Ziggler is so much better than that. But I get the impression that that's kind of what he's been like in WWE. And that's kind of like what he was like here. Who else did they really have to put in there with Sheamus? So him and Christian had a good exchange. Vader, the man they call Vader, was on this show. And Vader was the most over person, other than John Cena, who is getting way more cheers than boos lately, by the way. Aside from Cena, who's always going to be the most over guy with the live crowd, Vader was the most over person on the entire show. He got the big nostalgia pop. He came out. It was so nice to see that people knew who he was. Because far too often we've had legends that they put on TV and they've trotted out there, and the crowd is so silent that it's actually depressing. Dusty Rhodes made an appearance on a WWE, was it SmackDown? A few months ago, he did a segment with Cody, and I think Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, one of the most famous world champions of this generation, and he came out and got practically no response. Maybe it was a pay-per-view. I don't know. It was not that long ago. And there have been other legends that have appeared. Maybe it's because they always trot out the same ones. And Vader is somebody different. The last time I remember seeing Vader on Raw was... It may well have been in 05. 04, 05. When they did that whole angle where it was supposed to be Steve Austin against the coach. Talk about a brilliant idea on Vince McMahon's part. Austin had been retired for a few years, and his big idea was to bring Stone Cold Steve Austin out of retirement, and his first match back was going to be at a B-Show pay-per-view, I think it was Cyber Sunday or Taboo Tuesday or something, against Jonathan Coachman, and Austin was to have lost the match. So conveniently, about a week before the show, Austin tells WWE, "I hurt my back moving furniture at home. I can't wrestle at the pay-per-view." A wise move on Steve Austin's part, by the way. And so their backup plan was to put Batista in a match against the coach. And what ended up happening is they brought in Goldust and Vader, who had been off TV for a while. This was their big return. They brought back Goldust and Vader to actually have a match with... I don't remember if Coach was part of it as a 3-on-1, but it was going to be Goldust and Vader against Batista at the pay-per-view. And as Vader, poor Vader, Vader was leaving the ring. You can find the video on YouTube. It's kind of funny, actually. The segment ends, right? They've beaten down Batista, and the coach's music is playing. And Goldust leaves the ring, and Vader climbs through the ropes. And as he climbs through the ropes and falls to the... And his feet hit the floor, he was carrying so much more weight, so much excess baggage... in his belly, I guess you would say, that his weight carried him over and he fell to the ground. And people laughed. You can even hear Vader, I think, hurl an expletive because he was pretty pissed that that happened. Vader didn't look good there. Vader still is very, very heavy. His gut is just enormous. But apparently he has lost a bunch of weight. He's lost like 50 or 60 pounds. And he is physically in a better place now, I guess, than he's been in a long time. So good for him. People went nuts for him. It was good to see him. It was tough whenever he would have to get up. Like if he dropped an elbow and had to get up, it took him a while. His knees are probably completely shot. But he was a beloved figure, and he gave Heath Slater the Vader bomb. And when he gives you that Vader bomb with that big-ass gut that he's got, let me tell you right now, I saw Vader live in March, okay? When I went down to Miami for WrestleMania, myself, Noah Mark, and Brian Blade went to Wrestle Reunion 7. And I got to meet Bobby the Brain Heen, and I got to meet a whole bunch of legends while I was there. It was a great experience. And they had a live show. There were actually 3 days of the Wrestle Reunion convention. We happened to hit it that Saturday, which was the one day they had a legend show. So we stayed for the show. It was part of the ticket that we bought. And Vader made an appearance. I had no idea they were going to have the New Age Outlaws wrestled. And Vader wrestled, and Vader came out, and he had a match, of course, a handicap match against these two jobbers, kind of like what they do at Ryback. And Vader gave one of these guys a Vader bomb to win the match, and he, let me tell you something, this guy, probably, he just had to have had the wind knocked out of him. I would never agree to take a Vader bomb from Vader. I just wouldn't. I would be crushed. And Heath Slater looked like he got crushed, too. I'm sure it didn't feel too good to have all that weight coming down on you. He didn't hold back at all. So Vader wins, and Vader's 57 years old now. Looking pretty good, but I guess it's easier to look good at an older age when you have a mask on. That is true. And I believe Vader has been invited to be one of the legends that appears on the July 23rd 1,000th Raw episode. So we have not seen the last of the man they call Vader. That, to me, was... probably the highlight of the show on Monday night was the Vader appearance. The other thing on this show, we had sweet, innocent, psychotic AJ planting a big wet one on Kane, of all people. And I'm sure his big red wife could not have been too thrilled about that. But I say good for Kane. I think AJ is an upgrade from Tori and Lita, personally. But as I said earlier, the AJ character may actually be the most interesting thing going on right now in WWE. And I don't know what that says about the rest of the product, but I do enjoy her character. And it does help that you have this, it helps that you have this attractive young lady who, can smile at you and wink and then can just turn on you in a moment's notice. There's something about that I think that guys like. And, they say that AJ is a crazy chick. That's what CM Punk keeps saying. And that he likes crazy chicks and people like crazy chicks. And that's all well and good, but I dated a crazy chick once. And until you actually date one, and it's real easy to like crazy chicks until you date them. And then your perspective, I think, tends to change a little bit on that. But we had a lot of comedy on this show. Boy, do we have comedy. Get used to it. We're only going to get more of it. I use that term comedy loosely, by the way. If Vince McMahon randomly dancing backstage with women more than half his age and mocking one of his employees for having a disease and Ricardo Rodriguez wearing a Justin Bieber t-shirt is funny to you, then good for you. You'll probably enjoy Raw going forward. But just to sum up Raw, because there's no freaking way I'm recapping this entire show. This whole show was built around the return of Vincent Kennedy McMahon. After several months off television, he was back to evaluate the job performance of one John Laurinaitis. And as I said before, never mind the fact that the last time we saw Vince, I could have sworn he no longer had the authority to make decisions like this, and he was only the chairman in title, but I guess you can argue that he was stripped of his powers over Raw. I think, wasn't that the storyline? Triple H came out and said, you no longer have power over Raw? I don't know. This is all bullshit. Nobody can possibly keep all of this straight anymore, so it doesn't matter. But the people love seeing Vince, and on TV, too, since the ratings were way up for this show. So that was a plus. Unfortunately, I fear that means we're going to get so much more Vince that within a couple of weeks we're going to be totally sick of seeing him. But I am happy to report that, as I predicted, Vince McMahon... I said on the show that Vince McMahon ought to be very concerned. He ought to grow eyes in the back of his head and bring an army of security guards. Because every time Vince McMahon returns or pops back up on television in the month of June, bad things tend to happen. He either gets blown up or a piece of the set falls on top of him. Remember that? Remember when the Raw stage fell on him and he was laying there and Triple H was hovering over him? He's like, Paul, I can't feel my legs, Paul! Yeah. So, bad things tend to happen to the chairman. And this was no exception. Vince McMahon did not make it out of the show unscathed. The Big Show, at the end of the show, inadvertently struck Vince McMahon with his WMD knockout punch, which missed by a country mile. It looked terrible. I can understand him not wanting to really punch Vince in the face, but I mean... Vince let Randy Orton kick him full throttle in the head when he punted him a couple of years ago, and it looked great, although I do question allowing Orton to kick a 60-something-year-old man in the head like that. But it looked great. It was a great visual, and they replayed it and everything, and they replayed this from a different angle so it didn't look as bad, but from the angle they showed us originally on TV, this looked terrible, because clearly the punch, it wasn't even close. But Vince dropped like a rock. He was knocked out. And the show ended with John Cena with a dumbstruck look on his face, dumb being the key word, as Vince McMahon was tended to by medics. So, poor Vince. Somebody's out to get Vince. I think it's one of the writers, since they keep scripting this. I don't know who. I will put my detective glasses on and try to figure this out. I'm thinking it's Michael Hayes. Michael Hayes is trying to bump Vince McMahon off so he can take the top spot. That's what I think. But yeah, that was it. I mean, John Laurinaitis did not get fired. He almost got fired. But the Big Show came out and cut a promo and ripped on Vince. And Cena came out and he did stupid comedy. I hated that final segment. I just fucking hated it. And Vince decided, you know what? If Laurinaitis, if the Big Show loses, you're fired. And we got the stipulation on SmackDown that if John Cena loses, he's fired. I'm trying to figure out why... If Vince McMahon came back to Raw to evaluate the job performance of John Laurinaitis, And the whole theme throughout the show was that, John Laurinaitis, you better make this a goddamn good show. Because if you don't, when the show is over, I'm going to come out and I'm going to say two words to you. And you know what those two words are. Suck it. No, I'm kidding. You're fired. That was the whole theme of Raw. And Laurinaitis signed these different matches in the four-way to determine the new number one contender for the world title and a bunch of other stuff. And so obviously Vince McMahon did not think very highly of this because he was about to say, you're fired, to John Laurinaitis at the end of the show, and then the Big Show's music stopped him from doing so. If Vince McMahon doesn't think that John Laurinaitis is doing a good job, then just fucking fire him. Why didn't he announce the next day that he was fired? I mean, I don't understand this. What is just the whole notion of you better put these matches together and make this a good show. So, for example, I think the first match of the show was Sheamus and Tensai. And they had a hard-hitting affair. These two big dudes, you know, beat each other up. It was a fine match. It was a good match. And Sheamus beat him. And they had a backstage segment when it was over where Vince McMahon was like, uh-oh, you know, not good for you. You know, your guy lost. It's like, what do you mean your guy lost? What is this? Is this the alliance against Team WWF all over again? I mean, you're judging the guy's job performance on the quality of show that he puts together, not the fact that his so-called guy lost a match. So if Tensai won that match, Vince would have been happy? It just doesn't make any sense. Like, what is he evaluating exactly? I didn't really understand that. And then there was another segment on the show that actually infuriated me, which, and you can pretty much figure out what it was. I mean, obviously, Vince McMahon couldn't help himself. I talked last week on the show about Hornswoggle coming out on SmackDown and doing the JR impersonation and mocking his Bell's palsy. And again, Hornswoggle is a babyface character. He is not a heel. He did not do it because he's supposed to be an evil character to get heat. There was no reason to do it, but they did it. And Vince McMahon on this show was a babyface, too. And there he is sitting backstage with Hornswoggle, two babyfaces sitting there, Vince and his son. And he's contorting his face, and he's mocking Jim Ross, and it's like, eh, whatever. Yeah, I can't get angry about it anymore. I think I got all of my anger out last week. Vince McMahon is a jerk. We all know this. So it's almost to be expected from him at this point. He's so goddamn jealous of Jim Ross. It's like, I think that's really where it stems from. I've had people ask me that question before. That people have asked me, like, why does Vince McMahon hate Randy Savage so much? And everybody has their own theories, but honestly, I don't know why Vince McMahon hates Randy Savage. I don't have a good answer for you. I'm sure he likes him just fine now since he's dead, but what the heat was between the two of them, I have absolutely no idea. But with the Jim Ross stuff, my theory is that Vince McMahon is jealous. Because when they were announcers, Vince probably thought very highly of himself as an announcer. And Jim Ross was so much better than him just as a... And I loved Vince McMahon as an announcer. I mean, in some ways he was so bad he was good, but he was actually legitimately very good at getting over certain storylines. And he was very good. But he wasn't Jim Ross. You know, very few people were Jim Ross. Jim Ross happened to be very good at his job, more so than most everybody else. And I really feel like it stems from that. I'm sure it's other things too, but it stems from that and the fact that Vince is just a bully in real life. And you know, his brand of humor is he's like a big kid who never grew up. And the telling thing for me was there was an episode of Livewire where, the infamous episode of Livewire, the old show they used to have on Saturday mornings when it was legitimately live and they would take phone calls when Paul Heyman called in. When he was, you know, running ECW and he called in as Bruce from Connecticut and then he launched this tirade on the WWE product and why are you guys so afraid of ECW and all that. Vince was the special guest on Livewire that morning and they were taking live calls. And one person, I think, either emailed a question or called in and was asking, like, who... And at the time, they were doing the angle, I think, where Jim Ross went heel. This was in 96 and the short-lived heel Jim Ross character, where on commentary, you know, he would call the shows with King and Vince, and Jim Ross would insult Vince McMahon, and he was this disgruntled employee. So somebody, I think, called in and said, you know, who do you think is a better announcer, you or Jim Ross? And it was telling that Vince McMahon would not answer the question. He was so nervous and so evasive in answering the question. I really think there's something there in real life. I think it stems from that, I think. But, yeah, he was mocking him on the show. He couldn't help himself. But there was something else. There was a segment where John Cena confronted Vince McMahon. And Vince McMahon brought up the idea that, you know, Rock beat John Cena at WrestleMania. I forgot what the context of the conversation was, but Vince brought up the fact that John Cena got beat by The Rock at WrestleMania. And Cena's big response to this, because everything is a joke to him, his big response to this was, oh, so now we're using WrestleMania wins and losses to measure success in WWE. And I was just like, are you kidding me? Really? Are you fucking kidding me? This is coming from the guy who on television in the weeks leading up to WrestleMania cut promo after promo, sat in an empty arena at one point, looking up at that goddamn WrestleMania sign, talking about the fact that he had to win this match at WrestleMania. That's how important it was. If he didn't beat The Rock at WrestleMania, he was his existence. He would cease to exist. He wouldn't know what he would do with himself if he couldn't beat The Rock. It was so important to him. And of course he lost to The Rock and nothing changed. Not a goddamn thing changed. John Cena was the same John Cena he always was. He would come out on TV laughing and I mean, hell, the next night, for Christ's sake, I was at the building in Miami the next night for Raw when, you know, Cena came out and he was the same John Cena he always was. And Brock Lesnar came out, and what was John Cena's response to Brock Lesnar's coming out? He's standing there clapping like a goddamn seal, flapping his fins together. What the hell are you clapping about? This guy's about to murder you. But that's John Cena for you. And this would be a nothing segment. I wouldn't even bring it up. It's just, here he is mocking the idea that WrestleMania wins and losses mean anything. And, you know, supposedly this WrestleMania match this year was the biggest match of your life, and it just, everything you would ever accomplish would mean nothing if you didn't beat The Rock, and obviously it was all bullshit. So again, they wonder why we can't get into these matches sometimes. It's because they don't make them mean anything, or they try to, and then a couple weeks later, it's like it never happened. Just like the firing stipulation. I could rant about that all day, but I won't. So anyway, that was kind of Raw in a nutshell. I guess the other big thing is, again, AJ kissed Kane. I never thought there'd be a moment in my life where I would actually be jealous of Kane, but I was certainly jealous of Kane on Monday night, I will say. And it was funny because after AJ kissed him, AJ, again, for the benefit of those of you who, and I'm sure by now you know what happened, but it was a mixed tag match, Punk and AJ against Daniel Bryan and Kane. And AJ tagged in at one point. She did ring around the rosy on Kane, stood behind him. Kane turned around. She jumped up into his arms, planted a wet one on him for a good 20 seconds straight, it felt like. And Kane didn't know what to make of any of this, you know? Kane put her down, and he tagged out to Daniel Bryan, and Kane left. He deserted his partner. I can only imagine that Kane probably went to use the men's room backstage, if you know what I mean. Can't blame him. But where Kane went, I don't know. That I presume that's where he went. But AJ kissing Kane is one of those moments where you're watching it, you're like, wow, this is interesting. This is a very weird moment. So that was kind of, I don't know. It was interesting. Again, I like the AJ character. So that's it. That's all I got to say about Raw. I am not going to go segment by segment. Nothing else of any great note happened on the show. It's just kind of there. It's just, you know, Raw's going to have its good weeks and its bad weeks. You know what I mean? I mean, we're in a mode right now where TNA is putting on a consistently better product than Raw. They just are. You know, and you can deny that fact, but to deny that fact, I feel like it's just not give TNA a chance, which I have, and I'm happy I have, because I like wrestling. I like pro wrestling. I want to have fun when I watch pro wrestling. And it just so happens that right now I'm having more fun watching Impact than I am watching Raw. Now, maybe in a month when Raw goes 3 hours, they've got some big ideas up their sleeves, and that'll change. I hope it does. I'd love to have two great wrestling shows every week. But Raw sucks right now. Raw is absolutely excruciating to watch. And this week was no different. It had its moments, but on a 3-hour show, I need more than a couple of moments to keep my interest. One good match and Vader coming back, all due respect to Vader, is not enough. All right, let's do some quick shout-outs here. We got two of them to get to, and unfortunately, I was hoping to do a longer mailbag this week, since I didn't do one last week, and I don't think I'm going to be able to do one this week either. The show is closing in on very close to 2 hours here, which is hell of a lot longer than I had intended to go. So I will try to get to a lot of your questions individually. This is a horrible week for me, the last 2 weeks, actually. I've been extremely busy with work, and it's going to be really bad tonight, tomorrow. I'm going to miss Raw tomorrow night, so just bear with me, please. I promise you I will get to most of your questions, and hopefully we'll have a big old mailbag back on the show next week. Or maybe I'll just do a mailbag show one of these days. But let's get to some shout-outs here. James McAteer, who has been a listener since episode 101, says, I was recently diagnosed with MS, and I enjoy the show weekly. Can I get a shout-out? Absolutely, James. I am very sorry to hear of your diagnosis. Stay strong, my friend. He also noticed that on Raw this week, after Vince McMahon was clobbered by Big Show, the trainer threw up the dreaded X sign. And he says that this is the second time that James has seen this. And he says, I feel it is something that should not be used as a gimmick. It's like the boy who cried wolf. Well, yeah, kind of like claiming that if John Cena loses at the pay-per-view, he'll be fired. It's kind of the same thing. Jay from Florida writes in. He has been a loyal listener since episode 40. He says, after listening to episode 222 last week, I could tell you were really in a ranting mood, so I figured it was best to save my June 8th birthday shout-out for the next episode. The plans for my birthday dinner were postponed for 2 weeks due to a series of unfortunate events, so I am hoping your shout-out will give me some much-needed good luck. So happy belated birthday, Jay. Your series of unfortunate events has come to an end with that birthday shout-out right there. So that's going to do it for this week. I'm going to have to wrap things up now because I have to head out, actually, for work. I have something I need to tend to. So you can email me your shout-outs and your questions at thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is the email for anything and everything. Any other email address is a sham. Send it all to thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster, and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolemonster. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes as well. It is a very highly rated show. I appreciate that. A lot of reviews in there. If you don't believe me, you can just read some of the reviews that are up right now for the Sound Off in iTunes. It is free. It doesn't cost you anything. And you download it automatically when you are an iTunes subscriber. It's the easiest thing in the world. And it helps the show out a lot, the more people who subscribe in there. So I would appreciate it if you would oblige. So we're going to wrap up 223 for this week. Thank you all for the continued support that you have shown me. I very much appreciate it. And happy Father's Day again to all the dads out there. The dads, dads-to-be, new dads like Brian Blade. Congrats, buddy. And we'll be back here next weekend with episode 224. Hopefully some good thoughts on No Way Out and Raw and Impact. I'd love for all three shows to be awesome. What do you think the chances are that No Way Out is going to be excellent, Raw is going to be great, and Impact is going to be fantastic? Could it happen? Could we get the hat trick next week? I hope so. God, do I hope so. Until then, be well, stay safe, see you back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SCScoops.com.